Oh, yes, that was the Bewitched theme song, classic television introduction theme song, which we will discuss a little bit later on when we get to Bewitched. But this is S4E9, Welcome to Fanacheck, Dick York versus Dick Sargent, Part 2. I've had a lot of Facebook hate about this series I'm doing. So, you know, I did the first one, and then I advertised. I'm in a lot of different Facebook groups. Some of you probably are in those groups with me. And it's funny. So I made a post just saying, hey, you know, I'm going to be, you know, doing Dick York versus Dick Sargent to find out who the better Dick and going decade by decade. And everyone was like responding with who they thought was the better Darren, which, first of all, it's not even about Darren. I mean, that's only one aspect. It's like less than 5% of everything I'm talking about is Bewitched, I think Bewitched over these episodes is going to maybe constitute like 6 minutes of total speaking. But everyone made it about that. And so many people were like rolling their eyes, like, oh, this again, and all this bullshit. So for all you haters on Facebook out there, fuck off. Anyway, but some people were really cool about it and gave their opinion. It's an overwhelming Dick York. But then again, it's also an overwhelming Dick York as the favorite Darren, which again, I wasn't making it about just Darren. I wanted to look at everything. So let's recap. In part one, we basically took a look at both of their careers through the 50s. And they are tied each at 9 points. Dick York got a point for being an Emmy nominee. Then he got 8 points in the 50s for various cool things and whatnot. Dick Sargent got 1 point for having more credits. But then he also had 8 points in the 50s. So they are tied 9-9 going into the 60s. And that's where we're going to start. So let's jump right in to Dick York's 1960s. So, Mr. York started 1960 as a busy beaver. He had 3 TV credits and a movie. Ooh, it sounds like that, 3 Men and a Baby, 3 TV credits and a movie. Let's take a look here. What did he do? The TV credits were Alcoa Theater and Goodyear Theater. Those are, you know, basic anthology shows. They've both come up before in the podcast. But then he does an episode of The Untouchables, classic show, classic show. He should get a point for that, quite frankly. Let's take a look here. Pull up my handy dandy IMDb, and we will get to The Untouchables. It lasted from 1959 to 1963. Here's a synopsis, 119 episodes, by the way. Now, here's the aforementioned synopsis. Special Agent Elliot Ness and his elite team of incorruptible agents battle organized crime in 1930s Chicago. Well, how about that? Particularly the cast, scroll through it here. Robert Stack as Elliot Ness. Most of you probably know him from Unsolved Mysteries. Walter Winchell. Let's take a look. Any other big names here? Nothing really that I think a lot of people would know. I was looking at the various writers and directors, though, of this show. Two directors jumped out at me. The first one was Walter Grauman. He was the cousin of Sid Grauman, and you probably know him. He's known for like the Hollywood's Chinese and Egyptian movie theaters, the Grauman Theater. I lived in LA for a number of years, as I've talked about before, and I've been to the man's Chinese theater, Grauman's Chinese theater, whatever you want to call it. I was there once. A buddy of mine from Second City was in some horrible Godzilla movie. Like, it wasn't one of the big popular ones here, like with Matthew Broderick or that newer one they did with Bryan Cranston probably about 9-10 years ago. This was like some, I think it was made in Japan. It was pretty bad, but he had a small role in it. But we got to go to the premiere. So I went to the premiere of like this B movie at the Chinese theater. It's kind of cool. Anyway, so that's that. The second director, though, was Ida Lupino. Her name has come up a lot in my research. And she's basically the only female name I ever see when I'm looking up directors from this era. So I decided to do a kind of a mini deep dive on her. I feel like she's earned it. Ida Lupino, she was born February 4th, 1918. She died August 3rd, 1995. She had 105 acting credits, 42 directing credits, and 9 writing credits. Like, she wrote several screenplays and a few TV episodes. But lots of movie and TV. As far as the directing goes, really interesting stuff. She directed episodes of The Donna Reed Show, 77 Sunset Strip, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, which we'll be talking about a lot today, Have Gun Will Travel, The Rifleman, The Untouchables, of course, which we're talking about now, The Fugitive, Twilight Zone, Bewitched, a Dick York episode, by the way, so she directed one of those, Honey West, Gilligan's Island, and many more. She's a legendary, badass, pioneer woman, basically, so I thought I'd give her a mini deep dive, and I made a note to read some trivia about her. Not sure why. Let's take a look here. As rigid and tough-minded as Bette Davis, Lupino would often refuse to play a Davis hand-me-down role and was often suspended by Warner Brothers for doing so. It was during those breaks that she learned the craft of directing. Widely respected as a pioneer for women filmmakers, Lupino was the second woman to be admitted to the Directors Guild. How about that? So I'm glad I stumbled across her. I see her name so often that I thought, you know, gosh, I should probably give her a toss. My puppy barking out there. But I thought, again, I come across her name so often that I thought maybe I should give her a little bit of credit. So back to The Untouchables. Let's read a little review about The Untouchables. For those of you who have never seen the show, let me find a review here. This guy gives it an 8 out of 10. Most powerful, sometimes graphic, the best anti-crime show of all time. That's some strong words. This show's concept was hastily developed to become a one-hour weekly dramatic series after the success of the beautifully produced, made-for-television movie, The Scarface Mob. At first, the producers tried filming the capture of other important criminals using Elliot Ness, the TV film's fictionalized real-life hero, as their central character. Then they designed a unit like the 1930s Untouchable Squad depicted in the TV movie, a federal group combating gang activity and other crimes in Chicago, one headed by Ness, who worked out of an office in the city. He had six men with... Anyway, what else? This guy's going into so many details here. Anyway, 8 out of 10. There you go. About Elliot Ness. I also made notes to read some trivia here. Let's see what we can do here. According to testimony from Aladina Fratiano, who's Jimmy the Weasel, a mafia boss turned FBI informant, by the way, the Chicago family of the mafia ordered the assassination of producer Desi Arnaz because they didn't like A, the fact that the success of the show was focusing attention on the mafia, and B, the show's portrayal of Italians. Fratiano said that two hitmen hid themselves near Arnaz's house one night waiting for him to show up, but he never did. Shortly afterwards, the assassination order was rescinded when it was realized that Arnaz's murder would cause the mafia more trouble than it was worth. Wow, we almost lost Desi Arnaz because of this fucking show? That's kind of wild. Anyway, as a lot of you probably know, it was made into a classic 1987 film directed by Brian De Palma. I think it was written by David Mamet, starring Costner, Sean Connery, Robert De Niro as Al Capone. Famous scene where De Niro beats some guy's head in with a baseball bat. Sean Connery got an Oscar for this. I get it. The Untouchables, it's really cool to look at. It's like a beautifully filmed, like film noir looking movie. But I think it's overrated. I don't know. I watched it recently. I probably watched it about a year ago and I was a little bit underwhelmed. So that's my hot take on The Untouchables. Okay. Back to 1960, back to Mr. Dick York. He ends 1960 with the classic film Inherit the Wind, and he's getting a point for Inherit the Wind. It was based on a play. Here's the synopsis. Based on a real life case in 1925, two great lawyers argue the case for and against a Tennessee science teacher accused of the crime of teaching evolution. Sounds like present day Tennessee, quite frankly, because I live here, I can say that. Killer cast. Let me scroll through it here. Of course, Spencer Tracy. He gets a point for that one. Frederick March. Gene Kelly. Ooh, I didn't realize Gene Kelly was in this. I should give him another point for that. Who else? Anyone I know? Harry Morgan from MASH. Claude Akins. Wow. Pretty cool cast here, man. Norman Fell. I love Norman Fell. He was Mr. Roper. So here's how I remember this story. I've seen the movie, but first I read the play. And I remember specifically reading the play because I read it all in one day. I specifically remember reading the play all in one day because I was at Saturday detention. So I was probably in 6th or 7th grade. I got Saturday detention. I don't remember why, but I had to spend that Saturday in school, and I went to Catholic school, so I was in uniform, so my pants, my shirt, the tie, the whole deal, and I had to read all of Inherit the Wind and then write a report on it, and I'm not sure why Inherit the Wind. Anyway, that's how I remember it, so that's my Saturday detention story for you. Sadly, it wasn't the only time I got Saturday detention. I actually had it a few times growing up. Such is the glamour of going to Catholic school. So 1961 is a busy year for old Dick York. Lots of TV credits, Naked City, DuPont Show with June Allison, Insight, that's a religious show we've talked about before, General Electric Theater, Dr. Kildare. He does some classic shows too, as well as some stuff like I've never heard of. Classic stuff? Well, how about two episodes of The Twilight Zone? Huh? I think it's pretty classic. He did two episodes. One was called The Purple Testament, One was called A Penny for Your Thoughts. I think Twilight Zones are always so interesting that I thought I would go ahead and read both synopsises. So here's the synopsis for one of his Twilight Zones called The Purple Testament. A U.S. Army lieutenant serving in the Philippines during World War II develops a harrowing ability to see in the faces of the men of his platoon the men who will be the next ones to die. Bum, bum, bum. Who else is in that? No big names are in that with him, although Barney Phillips, he's in several Twilight Zones. Paul Mazursky was in this. There you go. How about that? Okay, so that's the first one. Now, the second one he did was A Penny for Your Thoughts. Let's read that synopsis. I'll pull it up. A Penny for Your Thoughts. Gaining telepathic abilities when his coin lands on its edge, bank clerk Hector B. Poole learns about the difference between other people's plans and fantasies. Now, how about that? Now, again, he did also do some shows I've never heard of. Those are the classic shows. The ones he's done that I've never heard of, he did one called The Americans in 1961, 17 episodes. So it did not last long. It did not survive 1961. Let's read the synopsis. During the American Civil War, two brothers fighting on opposite sides of the conflict. So it's about two brothers, I guess, which is something I never really thought about. Brother versus brother in the Civil War. Very original. That was sarcasm. Didn't play. Okay. A few notables appeared on this program, though. My grandma called it program, so I'm going to start calling it that. I'm watching my program. Slim Pickens appeared. Robert Culp. Ever heard of him? I did three episodes on that guy. George Kennedy, Robert Redford, Lee Marvin, Carol O'Connor, Jack Lord. I love Jack Lord. I'm toying with I'm not toying with it. I'm going to commit. You're hearing it here now for the first time. I'm going to do an episode on Jack Lord. But I've got some other episodes to do first. Ray Walston was also appeared on this. He was Mr. Hand in Fast Times at Ridgemont High, amongst other things. But I like him. He also did a show called Adventures in Paradise and one called Outlaws, which I never heard of those either. And a show called Frontier Circus. This is one I wanted to take a look at. I was like, how have I never heard of this? So Frontier Circus only went from 1961 to 1962, lasted 26 episodes. Here's the synopsis. A one-ring circus travels through the American West in the 1880s. Huh. Anyway, one of the leads in the show was John Derek. Right? He's the actor, director, husband of Bo Derek. And he didn't mind her getting naked. I know that. Check out Fantasies. He also directed, Bolero? I think he directed Bolero with her in it. She was like the it girl of the late 70s, early 80s. Go watch 10 as well with Dudley Moore. Oh my gosh, Bo Derek was so hot. Anyway, John Derek was her husband, directed her in a lot of things. Back to Dick York. This isn't about Bo Derek or John Derek. Back to Dick York. Now it's 1962. He does an episode of Thriller. That lasted from 1960 to 1962, only 67 episodes. We're going to read a review on Thriller because it's kind of cool. Let's take a look here. This is more like an advertisement for the DVD, sadly. I'll pull it up here. Here we go. Anthology series hosted by Boris Karloff that originally told ordinary tales of crime and mystery, but later became a showcase for gothic horror stories, many of which were based on works by authors such as Cornell Woolrich, I guess, Robert Bloch, and Charlotte Armstrong. Well, how about that? So we're going to give him some points for this stuff. Where was I? Here's why he gets a point, because it featured Boris Karloff. That's a classic actor. Let's read a review of this, though, because I don't really know much about this show. Let's take a look here. Pull up the reviews. This person gives it an 8 out of 10. Says Boris Karloff was the best. Now, if you ask Bela Lugosi, go check out the movie Ed Wood. Real funny. 1994 movie Ed Wood with Johnny Depp. There's a scene where Martin Landau, who's playing Bela Lugosi, yells about Boris Karloff. He's not fit to smell my shit. He had no respect for Boris Karloff. Anyway, here's the review. Never saw this series before I watched the DVD set. I was mostly impressed by it, though it took a while to find its way. It started out with crime thrillers, which ranged from moderately interesting to instantly forgettable, though when it showcased horror, it really hummed, with presentations like The Hungry Glass, The Grim Reaper, and Pigeons from Hell being the standouts. Boris Karloff presented all 67 episodes. How about that? So we're going to give Dick York a point for Boris Karloff. Now, moving on. During the years of 60 to 62, Dick York does six episodes of Alfred Hitchcock Presents. I'm giving him a point for that, because that is a classic show. Alfred Hitchcock Presents. I loved this show. I may have even loved it more than I loved The Twilight Zone. Let's read each synopsis for all six. All right, we're going to dive into this. I want to check this out. So now I'm going to have to manually scroll to each episode. So bear with me here, folks. Let's go to Dick York, pull up his filmography. You can play along at home. Let's take a look here. He's got 59 acting credits. I'm going to scroll down to the year. Alfred Hitchcock Presents. Okay, here we go. Let's take a look at Dick York's episodes. So first one he does is called Vicious Circle. Let's take a look. Vicious Circle. A hired killer reluctantly sets out to kill his own girlfriend as ordered by his crime boss, knowing he won't accept any failures. Bum, bum, bum. Sounds pretty cool. Here's the next one. The Dusty Drawer. A professor is convinced his boarding housemate, a bank teller, stole $200 from his bank deposit. The teller vehemently denies it. He wants his money back and employs a series of pranks to challenge the teller's sanity. But to what end? Dun, dun, dun. You always have to do that at the end. All right, let's take a look at the next one. The Blessington Method. Let me pull up the synopsis again. In the future year of 1980, life expectancy has increased dramatically, and J.J. Bunce provides an essential service. He approaches John Treadwell and informs him that his elderly mother-in-law, now in her 80s, and who lives with him full-time, will live at least another 32 years. Bunce's offer is quite simple. He will dispose of her for a fee. Initially, Treadwell rejects the suggestion out of hand, but at home, the old lady is becoming ever more demanding. In the end, he accepts Bunce's offer, but he does wonder what his own children might do when the time comes. Oop, he's going to get his own killing when he gets older. The next one, The Doubtful Doctor. A doctor examines a man who suffers from blackouts, in which he reverts to living and seeing things 2 years back in time. That's pretty wild. Let's take a look at the next one. We've got two more. You can't be a little girl all your life. That's true. I can't. Okay, here it is. A woman beaten by an unknown attacker comes under great pressure by her husband and the police to identify a suspect. Ooh. And then the last one, let's get here. It's called The 12-Hour Caper. Hope is super spooky. Okay. Herbert Wigham has been the assistant cashier at his securities trading firm for 11 years. He has always been a loyal employee, but things may be changing. He's advised by his boss that he will not be getting the head cashier position, as that will be going to another employee who just happens to be his wife's favorite nephew. Wigham goes ahead with an elaborate plan to steal $500,000 in bearer bonds that are scheduled for delivery late on a Friday afternoon. He's planned everything down to the minute, but has he forgotten one important factor? Dun, dun, dun. And that is all six of his Alfred Hitchcock Presents episodes. By the way, that last one included bearer bonds. A shocking amount of movies include people trying to steal bearer bonds, including Die Hard. If I'm not mistaken, those Germans are in that Japanese building, or the Nakatomi Towers, whatever it's called. Nakatomi? Who cares? Anyway, there are still bearer bonds, if I'm not mistaken. All right. That was a lot. All right, moving on. We are now in 1963 with Mr. Dick York. He kicks off the year with yet another show that is new to Ole Fanicek. It's called Going My Way. It went from 1962 to 1963. It only lasted 30 episodes. Wait, is that right? 30 episodes. Okay. Gosh, I was drinking last night. What do you want? Here is the synopsis for Going My Way. Father O'Malley is sent to a parish in lower class New York to assist old, crusty pastor Father Fitzgibbon. Miss Featherstone is the housekeeper in the rectory. When he arrives, Father O'Malley meets his boyhood friend Tom Colwell, who is running the local community center. Now, Tom Colwell is played by Dick York, and guess what, y'all? He is a series lead. This is Dick York's first show as a series lead, so no more guest starring for him. He is a series lead. Another lead is Gene Kelly. So he's going to get a Gene Kelly point here. He already got one for Inherit the Wind. I'll make it 1 point. We can't give 2 points for the same actor. So this is pretty neat. So he's graduating from recurring roles or guest starring stuff to getting his own show. So that's kind of cool. Of course, Gene Kelly, probably famous from Singing in the Rain, most famous for that anyway. It was recently came out that I guess Debbie Reynolds really didn't like him. I guess he was pretty mean to her. I was literally just reading some article about that. So Gene Kelly, maybe not the friendliest guy in town. But look at Dick York. It's 1963. He's got his own show, even though it only lasted 30 episodes. He's a series lead. He's working with Gene Kelly. Things are looking up for Dick York. And now 1963 fucking takes off. He does an episode of Route 66 with old George Maharis, right? Wrong. It was after Maharis left. It was a lame Glenn Corbett episode. Boo. Down with Glenn Corbett. Just kidding, Glenn. I hardly knew ye. Then Dick does a classic show, Rawhide. I'm going to give him a point for that. Then he does The Virginian. I mean, this is a killer year. And then he reunites with his old pal, Alfred Hitchcock, for an episode of the Alfred Hitchcock Hour, which was essentially like a continuation of Alfred Hitchcock Presents. Then he closes out the year with the last of three appearances that he would make on the series Wagon Train. He played a different character each time. I've talked about Wagon Train before. I know very little about it. I just always remember that funny scene. At least I thought it was funny. And Stand By Me, you know, when they're all around the campfire that night that they're camping out. And I think it's Will Wheaton's character's like, you ever notice on a wagon train, they never get anywhere? They just keep on wagon training. I don't know, made me laugh. But I thought to myself, why not finally read a synopsis about that damn show since, you know, I've done it so many times. So let's do that. Let's look up Wagon Train here. Let me pull it up for you guys. Let me hold on 1 second. And here we are. Okay, Wagon Train. Went from 1957 to 1965, 284 episodes. Here's the synopsis I promised. Stories of the journeys of a wagon train as it leaves post-Civil War Missouri on its way to California through the plains, deserts, and Rocky Mountains. So it's as advertised. They're doing a lot of wagon training. And now it's 1964. He gets his second series lead. And can you guess what it is? That's right, folks. We're finally there. It is Bewitched. Classic show. This would be the show that Dick York was remembered for. It took us a while to get here. All the people on Facebook already chiming in saying Dick York is the better Darren. So Bewitched, let's finally dive in and talk about it. Went from 1964 to 1972, 254 episodes. Dick York was in 5 of the 8 seasons. That's 170 of the 254 episodes. For you math geeks, that is 66.9% of the Bewitched. So he's going to get a point for being the more tenured Darren for sure. He was in almost 67% of the episodes. I'll go ahead and read you the IMDb synopsis. A witch married to an ordinary man cannot resist using her magic powers to solve the problems her family faces. But we're going to do some half-assed research here. Let me pull some up. Let's read. You guys like to hear me read, don't you? So here's some half-assed research. Bewitched is an American fantasy sitcom television series that originally aired for 8 seasons on ABC from September 17th, 1964 to March 15th, 1972. It is about a witch who marries an ordinary mortal man and vows to lead the life of a typical suburban housewife. The show was popular, finishing as the second-rated show in America during its debut season, staying in the top 10 for its first 3 seasons, and ranking in 11th place for both seasons 4 and 5. The show continues to be seen throughout the world in syndication and on recorded media. Now, it was created by Saul Sachs under the executive producer Harry Ackerman, and it starred Elizabeth Montgomery as Samantha Stevens, Dick York as Darren Stevens, Dick Sargent later replaced him, but we'll get to that. Of course, Agnes Moorehead as Andora, that was Samantha's mother. David White as Darren's boss, Larry Tate. Who else? Alex Pierce as Gladys Kravitz. Erin Murphy, of course, was Tabitha Stevens. And I think she was with her twin sister, Diane Murphy. But Erin Murphy seems to be the more popular of the two. Paul Lind was in it as Uncle Arthur. Maurice Evans was Samantha's father. Alice Ghostly as Esmeralda. That was Tabitha's babysitter. Lots of folks were in this. A lot of famous people. So that's some half-assed research. Some fun fact about the intro, because I played the intro song at the beginning of the pod. Hanna-Barbera produced the opening and closing animation credits. So, of course, it was famously animated. A lot of shows were back then. And Hanna-Barbera did that, which I thought was kind of neat. Another fun fact, in 2002, Bewitched was ranked number 50 on TV Guide's 50 Greatest TV Shows of All Time. In 1997, the same magazine ranked the season 2 episode, Divided He Falls, on their list of the 100 Greatest Episodes of All Time. That's a lot of greatest lists, huh? Let's get a little more in depth. What do you say? So we're going to dive a little deeper in our research here. So a more in-depth analysis or synopsis, rather. A beautiful witch named Samantha meets and marries a mortal man named Darren Stevens, of course, Dick York, then later Dick Sargent. While Samantha complies with Darren's wishes to become a normal suburban housewife, her magical family disapproves of the mixed marriage. Mixed marriage. I love that. That would be fucking perfect today. But her magical family disapproves of the mixed marriage and frequently interferes in the couple's lives. Episodes often begin with Darren becoming the victim of a spell, the effect of which wreak havoc with mortals such as his boss, clients, parents, and neighbors. By the epilogue, however, Darren and Samantha most often embrace, having overcome the devious elements that failed to separate them. The witches and their male counterparts, warlocks, are very long-lived. While Samantha appears to be a young woman, many episodes suggest she's actually hundreds of years old. To keep their society secret, witches avoid showing their powers in front of mortals other than Darren. Nevertheless, the effects of their spells and Samantha's attempt to hide their supernatural origin from mortals drive the plot of most episodes. Witches and warlocks usually use physical gestures along with their incantations. To perform magic, Samantha often twitches her nose, which I always thought was the cutest thing. She's so beautiful. But she often twitches her nose to create a spell. Blah, 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 blah. All right. So creator Saul Sachs, his inspiration for the series were the films I Married a Witch, which was developed by from Thorne Smith's unfinished novel, The Passionate Witch. In I Married a Witch, Wallace Woolley is a descendant of people who executed witches at the Salem Witch Trials. As revenge, a witch played by Veronica Lake prepares a love potion for him. She ends up consuming her own potion and falling for her enemy. So it goes on and on about that. Both films were produced by Columbia Pictures, which also owned Screen Gems, and that's the company that produced Bewitched. So that was a long way of saying this was inspired by a couple of Columbia movies, and of course Columbia owned Screen Gems, and that's how we got that. Saul Sachs received the credit as the creator of the show. He wrote the pilot of Bewitched, but was not involved with the show after the pilot. So after that, he bailed. The show won 3 Emmy Awards. William Asher won the Primetime Emmy Award for Outstanding Directing for a Comedy Series in 66. Alice Pierce posthumously won the Primetime Emmy Award for Outstanding Supporting Actress in a Comedy Series for her portrayal of Gladys Kravitz. And Mary Lorne won the same award posthumously in 1968 for her portrayal of Aunt Clara. Now, we spoke in the last episode about Dick York's chronic pain forcing him to leave the show. Let's touch on that again here a little bit. The fifth season of Bewitched, which was 1968 to 1969, proved to be a turning point for the series, most notably with the mid-season departure of Dick York and the record 8 episodes which were filmed without him afterwards. Although aired out of order with previously filmed episodes. York was suffering from recurring back problems, a result of an accident during the filming of They Came to Cordura. As a result, many episodes in seasons 3 and 4 had York's character of Darren out of town on business. Towards the end of season 5, York's increased disability, which had caused numerous shooting delays and script rewrites, resulted in his collapsing on set in January of 1969 while filming the episode Daddy Does His Thing. He was immediately rushed to the hospital, and after a long talk with producer-director William Asher, York decided to leave the series. At about the same time, Montgomery and Asher announced that they were expecting another baby, and it was decided that Samantha and Darren would also have another child in the fall of that year. On screen, Samantha tells Darren over the phone the news of her second pregnancy in the fifth season episode, Samantha's Good News. Man, that is tough. We'll talk about the final seasons and how it ended when we get to Dick Sargent. But here's something for that Dick York did. One fun thing that he did. He played Darren Stevens in an episode of The Flintstones. I think it's so awesome. It was titled Samantha. It aired on October 22nd, 1965. Let me find a synopsis on this one. I got to find it though, because I was searching through The Flintstones. Let me just pull it up here real quick. I love that he did an episode of The Flintstones. I'm giving him a point for that. That is pretty neat. Where is that episode of The Flintstones? Here it is. So again, this is from 1965. Fred and Barney go on a weekend camping trip, claiming that women can't rough it as they do. Can't rough it as they do. In response, Samantha Stevens takes Wilma, Betty, and the children camping, using her magical twitch of the nose whenever necessary to upstage the boys. Now, what they don't explain is how the hell they went back in time to prehistoric times, but the animation looks pretty cool. And of course, it's all Hanna-Barbera, so that's why that kind of makes sense. So the animation is also not only in keeping with the Flintstones, but in keeping with the opening titles of Bewitched. It's Elizabeth Montgomery, of course, she appeared on it as well. By the way, Elizabeth Montgomery, one of the great beauties of all time. She, you know, passed away in 1995 at the age of 62, young, just like her two Darrens. You know, they both died in their early 60s as well. So I think that's kind of interesting. Dick York left the show in 1969. He wouldn't work again until 1983. His painted addiction ravaged his career. So I guess there won't be much competition in the 70s, but we'll get back to that, though. I've got something to say about that. So let's now turn to Dick Sargent. We'll talk about his 60s. Dick Sargent kicks off the 60s with three TV appearances and a movie. Just like Dick York, right? Three TV shows and a movie. The three TV shows were single episodes of Wichita Town, The Alaskans, and The Millionaire. I know The Millionaire has come up a lot on the podcast before. The other two, not so much. So Wichita Town, let's take a look at that. 1959 to 1960, it lasted 26 episodes. Here is a synopsis for you as I pull it up. Take your time, phone. I'm not busy or anything. Here we are. Wichita, Kansas, USA. Was a growing town after the American Civil War. Helping the town grow were Marshal Mike Dunbar and his deputies, Ben Matheson and Rico Rodriguez. Also appearing were town doctor Nat Windham, blacksmith Anus McClanahan, and Joe Clingston, the bartender in the local saloon. Look at that. So that is Wichita Town. No big name lead actors, but guests included James Coburn, love him, L.Q. Jones, Robert Vaughn, Vic Morrow. Oh, he comes up a lot on the podcast too. There's Jennifer Jason Leigh's dad who died on the set of The Twilight Zone, the movie. Don Grady from My Three Sons did this. It's funny, when I think of Wichita or a TV show about Wichita, there's a great show on Netflix, do yourself a favor, called Love. Love this show. It only lasted three seasons. Well, I don't know if it just lasted. I mean, it was like a full story, so maybe it was intended to only go three seasons because it concluded where it should. Fantastic show, but within it, one of the lead characters is a TV writer, and he writes for a show called Wichita. The idea being witch, so Wichita. It's like a witch show that takes place in Wichita because Wichita has the word witch in it. And I thought it was, something I should mention since we're going to mention or we've already talked about Bewitched, and I feel like I'm rambling on. Maybe it wasn't that interesting, but your takeaway should be this. Go watch the show Love on Netflix. Great, great show. All right, now, The Alaskans. Let's take a look at that. That's the other show he did this year that I didn't know anything about. I'm betting it's about Alaskans. That's just a guess. 1959 to 1960, 37 episodes. Here is the synopsis for The Alaskans. When gold was discovered in the Yukon in the 1890s, thousands of hopeful prospectors headed north for a chance at becoming rich. The easiest passage to the Yukon was through the small Alaskan port town of Skagway, which quickly exploded into a sprawling boomtown, offering almost everything a miner could want. For a price. Adventurers Silky Harris and Reno McKee have arrived in this town looking to make their fortunes, not mining for gold, but by catering to and fleecing the hardy, hard-living miners who pass through there. Kind of sounds like Deadwood a little bit, doesn't it? So when you think about this, one of the adventurers is Silky Harris. Now, when I read that, I'm thinking like of maybe an old redneck beer belly prospector, or maybe like a rugged Tom Selleck type. It could go either way, I guess. What I was not imagining is who it actually was. It was Roger Moore. Like, that's just so bizarre to me. James Bond playing Silky Harris, or whatever the fuck his name was. Yeah, Silky Harris as prospector. I think that was interesting. So Roger Moore in an early TV appearance. The movie Dick Sargent, though, did this year in 1960 was The Great Imposter with Tony Curtis and Carl Malden. And that kind of concludes his 1960. So he's got a really busy 60s, actually, because in 61, he does more TV. Dr. Kildare, Death Valley Days, and of course, One Happy Family. I was not familiar, I guess because it only lasted 15 episodes in 1961, but Dick Sargent was the lead. Boom. So just like Dick York, he's now getting his own shows, right? So he gets a point for that. Let's look up the synopsis of Dick Sargent's first series lead. Dick and Penny, funny, Dick. Dick and Penny Cooper are married but can't afford their own home. They decide to move in with Penny's parents, Barney and Mildred Hogan, and her grandparents, Charlie and Lovey Hackett. The stories revolve around the troubles that occur when generations clash. Well, how about that? Sounds funny. Couldn't have been too funny, though, because it only lasted 15 episodes. But hey, Dick Sargent's on the board, man. He's got his own show. 1962 gets even busier for Mr. Sargent. Does an episode of Gunsmoke, gets a point for that. The Alfred Hitchcock Hour, The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet. So, oh gosh, I'm going to give you a point for that one too. So we did an episode of that. Of course, that show starred Ozzy and Harriet Nelson. Also on the show is her son, Ricky Nelson, who became a big music star, passed away in a plane crash. He had three kids, Tracy Nelson, she was an actress, and then Gunnar and Matthew Nelson. They were known as the Nelson twins. I've regaled you with this story before, but I met old Matthew Nelson at a Lowe's here in Franklin, Tennessee. Not to be braggy, but it's true. I was there to buy mulch, and you know what? Matthew Nelson of the Nelson twins, he too purchases mulch. He's just like us. And anyway, I started talking to him and his wife, and they had a little baby with them, and the wife was holding the baby, and she referred to him as Ozzy. And I was like, oh my God, the baby's name is Ozzy after his great-grandfather, Ozzy Nelson. So I thought that was cool. And of course, another star of The Adventures of Ozzy and Harriet was Don DeFore. And I had his son, Ron DeFore, on the podcast back a couple seasons ago. So look that up. So that's kind of cool. I'm going to give Dick Sargent a point for doing The Adventures of Ozzy and Harriet. Also in 62, he does Alcoa Premiere. That's an anthology show. He did Kraft Mystery Theater. That's an anthology mystery show. And then an episode of Follow the Sun, a short-lived TV show about magazine writers in Hawaii. I'm not going to read about it, but I will tell you this. If I were ever an actor, I think I'd have to jump on a show that's filmed in Hawaii. I just have to do it. Why not? Go live in Hawaii 6 to 9 months out of the year? Yes, please. In 1962, he also does a film, That Touch of Mink. And he's going to get some points for this one. Let me pull up That Touch of Mink. This was kind of a big deal. Here's the synopsis. A rich businessman and a young woman are attracted to each other, but he only wants an affair while she wants to save herself for marriage. Huh, it's interesting. The cast was Cary Grant and Doris Day. I mean, how about that? So they're the leads. So I'm going to give them points for that. Cary Grant is a point. Doris Day is a point. Who else was in this? Audrey Meadows was in this. Audrey Meadows, of course, she was Alice Cramden in The Honeymooners, man. John Astin is in this. That's Sean Astin's dad. Not his biological dad, but his dad. And he was, of course, Gomez Adams in the TV show The Addams Family, amongst other things. I think he just passed away not too long ago. So pretty cool cast there. This movie, That Touch of Mink, was directed by Delbert Mann. He's an Oscar-winning director. He directed Marty, and he won Best Director for that. That's a great movie. That Touch of Mink itself was nominated for 3 Oscars as well. So it was nominated for Best Original Screenplay. It was nominated for Best Art Direction and Best Sound. It was shut out in all 3, but I'm going to give Dick Sargent a point for being in a movie that was nominated for Best Original Screenplay. That's worthy of a point. So I made a note to read some of the trivia, some select trivia about this movie. They jumped out at me. Here's one of them. In her autobiography, Doris Day wrote, "Of all the people I performed with, I got to know Cary Grant least of all. He is a completely private person, totally reserved, and there is no way into him. Our relationship on That Touch of Mink was amicable, but devoid of give and take. Not that he wasn't friendly and polite, he certainly was, but distant, but very professional. Maybe the most professional, exacting actor I ever worked with. In the scenes we played, he concerned himself with every little detail, clothes, sets, production values, the works. Cary even got involved in helping to choose the kind of mink I was slated to wear in the film." So there you go, that's one trivia. And here's the other one I want to read. Cary Grant was a big fan of The Honeymooners and Audrey Meadows in particular, and was responsible for getting her the part of Connie. So I love that. I love Audrey Meadows. I too love The Honeymooners. That was pretty cool. And that concludes 1962 for Dick Sargent. 1963 starts with a bang. He does an episode of Hazel, a show starring Don DeFore, who I just mentioned. I had his son Ron DeFore on the show. I've also got a Hazel TV guide from the 50s, I believe. Maybe it's the 50s? I think it is. But I've got a small collection of some old TV guides. I've got a Banachek, a Columbo, a Lancer, a Kojak, and I've got a Hazel. And they are all displayed here in my home office that I'm sitting in as we record. Also, it's kind of funny. I didn't know Hazel before reading about Don DeFore and interviewing his son. Hazel was just never on my radar. But I was recently watching a Mad Men episode. I'm in the process of rewatching Mad Men. And there's a scene where Betty Draper is in her living room watching Hazel. I'm like, oh, well, now I know what the hell that is. Then Dick Sargent does yet another TV show I never heard of. Should I even be allowed to host this podcast, by the way, with all these fucking shows I've never heard of? The show is called Ripcord. It lasted from 1961 to 1963, 76 episodes. I'm going to go ahead and read about it for you, because that's what I do. A skydiver and a pilot, on their private airplane are placed in unusual situations where their special skills and abilities are needed, leading them on exciting adventures from chasing dangerous criminals to performing difficult rescues. That sounds kind of cool, honestly. The leads are small time, but the guests are cool, man. Lee Van Cleef guested, Harry Carey Jr., Russell Johnson. Again, I feel like Russell Johnson keeps coming up lately. He was the professor in Gilligan's Island. I went like 54 episodes ever mentioning him, and now it's like every episode. Diane Cannon did this show. James Coburn did this show. He came up earlier. I love James Coburn. Fun thing that I found, one of the many writers credited was Robert Louis Stevenson. Now, this jumped out at me because I'm like, Robert Louis Stevenson died probably 100 years before, before TV was invented. I'm like, what the hell happened here? But I guess they used a story of his for an episode. So Robert Louis Stevenson is a credited writer on this show. Now, here's an interesting review. I made note that this was interesting, but I make no promises. Okay. Here's the title, an early show that had the merchandising touch. Oh, yes, this was interesting. Okay, this caught my eye. So many films and TV shows today are made that make money off the merchandising end. This was an early TV show that did that. Two guys run a parachute center and help out the police, forest rangers, and so on. They fight crime, rescue people, etc. But the best part of this show was that it produced a neat toy. For $1.98, you could get your very own toy parachute made of a heavy plastic with a little toy army man attached who would come floating down to earth after you packed the chute and tucked it into the opening on his back and threw it into the air. For kids of the late 50s, early 60s, this was great. The show, on the other hand, was pretty much the same week to week. The skydiving scenes, however, were authentic. Considering the difficulty in filming something like this during this time period, it would have had to be considered a little ahead of its time. The late Ken Curtis, who is best remembered as Festus on Gunsmoke, starred in this action series. Well, that's kind of cool. So it was an early merchandising tool. I had one of those as a kid. Actually, I had that several of those with the army guy, with the parachute, and it never really worked. You throw it off of something and... it's just like Slinky. I had Slinkies. Those fucking things don't go down the stairs. That's all horseshit. Anyway, 1963 also had Dick Sargent doing two movies. And my man is about to rack up some serious points. If I were Dick York, I'd be scared right now. For Love or Money with Kirk Douglas, he gets a point for that. And he does Captain Newman MD with Gregory Peck. He gets a point for that. That movie also had Tony Curtis in it, Eddie Albert, Angie Dickinson. You might remember Angie Dickinson from when I regaled you with my Big Bad Mama synopsises. Robert Duvall was also in Captain Newman MD, so I'm giving him a point for that. Larry Storch was in it. Bobby Darin was in it. I got to give him a point for Bobby Darin, too. Bobby Darin, big time actor, also big time singer. Mac the Knife, splish splash, I was taking a bath. But Mac the Knife is one of the best ones. That's Bobby Darin. They made a movie about Bobby Darin. Who the hell was it? Oh, shit. Kevin Spacey. It was kind of like a vanity project for Spacey. I think he wrote and directed it as well, or at least directed it. And I don't know. It wasn't a very good movie, but Bobby Darin's a pretty interesting guy. This film also got 3 Oscar nominations, Best Actor nomination for Bobby Darin, so he's getting a point for that, Best Adapted Screenplay, so Dick Sargent is getting a point for that, Best Sound, and it got 4 Golden Globe nominations, Best Picture Drama, Best Actor Drama for Gregory Peck, Best Supporting Actor for Bobby Darin, so those are 3 points, but here's a weird Golden Globe nomination that this movie got, Best Film Promoting International Understanding. And I was like, what is that? So I've never heard of Best Film Promoting International Understanding. So I looked it up. It was given out by the Golden Globes from 1946 to 1964. I guess we stopped giving a shit in 1964 about international understanding. Maybe it's because the Beatles had landed and they taught us everything we need to know about international stuff. Who knows? But some of the winners over the years included To Kill a Mockingbird, The Diary of Anne Frank, and The Day the Earth Stood Still. They all won our Golden Globes for Best Film Promoting International Understanding. So moving on, back to Dick Sargent, speaking of 1964, now we're in 1964. So 1964 is a lazy year for Dick. All he does is 2 episodes of Wagon Train. And as we know, they never get anywhere. They just keep on wagon training. Now on to 1965 and more points because he gets another series lead. Man, Dick Sargent's kind of crushing it here, guys. Don't get mad at me if Dick Sargent wins this thing. He gets a show called Broadside. It lasted 32 episodes. Here, I'll pull up a synopsis. Of course, my phone locked on me here. Broadside. Again, 64 to 65, 32 episodes. Here's the synopsis. Lieutenant Ann Morgan and her fellow Waves are posted to the backwater station on Ranikai, much to the displeasure of Commander Adrian, who schemes to transfer the women to keep from disrupting his South Seas... I don't know. What the hell is it? What are they even talking about? Is there another synopsis for this? Sorry, guys. I don't even know what this is about. Kathleen Nolan, Andrew Edwards, or Edward Andrews, rather, Dick Sargent, Sheila Cool, George Firth was in this. I don't know what the... I'm going to have to look up a review because that synopsis made no sense to me. Let's read a review. From Michaela... This person gives it a 7 out of 10. The first feminine military sitcom. Well, that makes more sense. So it is military. From McHale's Navy producer and creator, Edward Montage. Broadside is the first military sitcom with women as the central characters, which set it apart from most of its competitors, like Ensign O'Toole and its originator. The show has an interesting cast, which included a pre-Bewitched Dick Sargent and post-Real McCoy's Kathleen Nolan. Unfortunately, the show was scheduled against ratings giant The Ed Sullivan Show, which sealed its fate and so on and so forth. Of course, my wife is the granddaughter of one of the producers of The Ed Sullivan Show, so there you go. But he got his own lead, so I'm giving him a point for that. He was a series lead in this. And the leads were lame on the show, but here's the guests, man. The guests were really fun on this show. You had Robert Pine as Chris Pine's dad. Chris Pine, of course, the big famous actor. Hey, do yourself a favor. I don't know if you're following this story. So, you know, Olivia Wilde recently directed some damn movie. I forget what it was called. Don't Worry, Darling or something like that. Wow, hear that? What is that? That was crazy. We just got like this big burst of wind or I don't know if it was a helicopter or what the hell it was. But anyway, we are back to it. So Olivia Wilde directed some movie. I think it was called Don't Worry, Darling. And one of the leads in is Harry Styles. Of course, Chris Pine is in it as well. You know, the big story was that she started dating Harry Styles. But there was this whole story about how Harry Styles, while they're promoting the movie, spit on Chris Pine. And when you go back and watch the video, it really does look like he spit on Chris Pine. It's kind of interesting. I don't know if he did or not. They all deny it. But it looks like he's about to sit down next to Chris Pine and he spits on his lap. Anyway, I thought I'd mention that. But Robert Pine was in this show. Another guest star on this show was Sammy Shore. So let's discuss him. He was a comic. Sammy Shore was a comic. He used to open for Frank Sinatra. He and his wife bought Ciro's, which was a cool club on the Sunset Strip. They turned it into the Comedy Store, which so it could be a showcase basically for Sammy. His wife ended up running it. Mitzi Shore ran it for years and years and years. There was a house behind it, and so that's where she lived. And you had to, I think if you wanted to be a comic at the Comedy Store, it came with some ancillary things you had to do, like oftentimes going to that house to babysit her son, Pauly Shore. Also, I think you had to bang her sometimes. So Mitzi Shore is like a real famous personality who ran the Comedy Store. And there's lots of stories about comics having to sleep with her and all that stuff. Anyway, she passed away. Jerry Seinfeld hated her. I think she told Jerry Seinfeld he wasn't funny. She didn't want to give him a start. And for, you know, of course, he blew up and became huge. And for years, he'd see her as he was driving in her neighborhood. And he'd always make sure to like give her a big wave and everything. And she wouldn't even look at him because she was wrong about Jerry Seinfeld. But anyway, that is Sammy Shore. And that was the show. What was it called? Broadside. Okay. That was a fun tangent. Okay. Now wait, speaking of Pauly Shore, before I move on, another thing that's been in the news is Pauly Shore wants to do a biopic about Richard Simmons. I don't know if you heard about that at all. So Richard Simmons, of course, has basically been in hiding for like 10 years. No one's seen the guy. And Pauly Shore's like putting together this big campaign to be the lead in a biopic about him. And of course, Richard Simmons came out and said, no, he's not interested. And I'm like, yeah, I bet. I think if he wants a biopic done, he wants a better actor than fucking Pauly Shore playing him. But I don't know, it just made me laugh. Anyway, back to Dick Sargent. Back to 1965. He does a movie called Fluffy with Tony Randall and Shirley Jones. Talk about a simple synopsis. Here it is. A lion gets famous. That's right. A lion gets famous. That's synopsis for this. That's the synopsis for the movie. Jim Backus was also in this. Like Russell Johnson, this is another Gilligan's Island alum that I feel like keeps coming up in the podcast. I won't be watching Fluffy because I don't care about famous lions. But I might watch Dick Sargent's next movie. It was called Billy, 1965. It's got a kind of a cool poster. I might pull it up here and see if it says anything interesting. It looks really cool. First, I'm going to pull up the movie Billy here. Where is Billy? 1965. A 16-year-old tomboy and high school athlete finds herself caught between beating boys at sports and having a boyfriend, while her conservative father opposes women's rights in his campaign for mayor. That's crazy. It stars Patty Duke. Like I said, it's got a really cool poster. Billy's got the beat, the heartbeat, the laugh beat, the upbeat, the action beat. And it's Patty Duke as Billy. Well, there you go. So I kind of dug that. Now, We're in 1966. And the year kicks off with a movie I loved as a kid. The Ghost and Mr. Chicken. I'm giving Dick Sargent a point for this. I loved this movie when I was a kid. It used to scare the shit out of me. I wonder if it holds up. I'd have to go back and rewatch it. But The Ghost and Mr. Chicken, him and Don Knotts, Dick Sargent, Don Knotts, can't get a better duo than that. A timid typesetter hasn't a ghost of a chance of becoming a reporter until he decides to solve a murder mystery and ends up spending a fright-filled night in a haunted house. Of course, the guy who spent the night in the haunted house was Mr. Don Knotts. His handsome friend was Dick Sargent. Let's read a review on this one. You got to read a review because everyone loved this movie. This guy gives it a 9 out of 10. Attaboy, Luther. That was a recurring line in the movie. The first film Don Knotts made after leaving Mayberry to sign a multi-film contract with Universal, I first saw The Ghost and Mr. Chicken as a tiny tot when it played in support of Munsters Go Home at the drive-in. And it was so funny, I forgot all about the severe sunburn I had acquired at the beach earlier in the day. And now, 37 years later, it's still hilarious. An adult, especially a college graduate who majored in English, isn't supposed to admit that The Ghost and Mr. Chicken is one of his favorite films. At least not without embarrassment at his lack of sophistication, but I admit it with pride. Knotts may not have had a film career on par with Laurel and Hardy, but he's their equal in my book, and this is his best film. It even manages to be genuinely spooky at times. That's what I thought, too. It scared the shit out of me. That organ music, yikes! This is a comedy classic and a family film in the best sense of the word. It really was. It was a great movie. So, later in 1966, Dick Sargent does 6 episodes of the Tammy Grimes Show. And guess what? He was a lead! He's getting a point for that one, too. This is like his third lead now. He only did 6 episodes because it only lasted 6 episodes, so it couldn't have been a very good show. I should maybe take a point away. But here is the Tammy Grimes Show. A short-lived series about a rich heiress who wants nothing more than to spend her money. But her Uncle Simon's keeping a tight hand on the wallet. Her twin brother Terrence and her housekeeper, Mrs. Ratchet, are also an irritation to Tammy. So there you go. It premiered on the same day as Star Trek. And then she's literally same day, same time slot, everything is Star Trek. Who is Tammy Grimes, by the way? Let's read a review. I don't know who Tammy Grimes is, but I think it mentions it in the review. The review is Tammy and the Script Doctor. With her distinctly angular face and her distinctly smoky voice, with that cool mid-Atlantic accent, Tammy Grimes was one of the most unique and attractive talents of the 1960s. Fresh from her triumph in the Broadway musical High Spirits, in which she played a very sexy ghost named Elvira, Miss Grimes was set to conquer television in 1966 as the star of a new sitcom in which she would again play a bewitchingly supernatural woman. How about that? Bewitchingly. Bum, bum, bum. However, when she learned that her work in this TV series would involve lots of time-consuming trick photography for the special effects, she then vowed that the sitcom would be a flop and she quit. So there you go. Tammy Grimes cometh, Tammy Grimes goeth away. Okay. We're going to cruise into 1967, and Dick Sargent does 2 episodes of Daniel Boone and an episode of a short-lived series called Accidental Family, starring Jerry Van Dyke. Of course, he was one of the leads in Coach as Dick Van Dyke's brother. In 1968, Dick Sargent does 3 back-to-back movies. They all look interesting, so we shall discuss them. The first is The Private Navy of Sergeant O'Farrell. Here's a synopsis. During World War II, Sergeant O'Farrell's Pacific unit is demoralized when a Japanese submarine torpedoes an American supply ship containing beer. I love that. Fun synopsis, right? Bob Hope was in this. Phyllis Diller, Gina Lola Brigida. I'm going to give him points for Bob Hope and Phyllis Diller. The second movie that was interesting this year, The Young Runaways. This one seems a little more serious, kind of has a cool poster. I'll pull up the poster here. Here's the synopsis, though. The Young Runaways. It's really long, so let me find a shorter one. Here's a shorter one. Follows the lives of 3 unrelated teenagers as they run away from their respective homes, each for different reasons. Arriving in Chicago, one tries to make good with his life only to find it a little more difficult than he had imagined. One falls in with the rock and roll set and comes to a violent end. And one gets mixed up with prostitutes but comes good in the end. I bet he came good in the end. Shows things from both the parent side and the kid side. The underlying story is that you can't solve your problems on the road if you can't solve them at home. Bum, 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 bum. The more you know. Let me pull up the poster. The poster looks cool visually. They experiment with drugs, with sex, with each other. There's no stopping the Young Runaways. Cool poster. I kind of dig it. The cast includes Norman Fell, Richard Dreyfuss, Isabel Sanford. She was Wheezy in The Jeffersons. Armie Archer was in this. One of the leads, though, here, kind of interesting story. One of the leads was an actor named Kevin Coughlin. I'm going to read a trivia on him. It caught my eye. I didn't know who Kevin Coughlin was, but I kind of peripherally knew that there was something going on with this guy because I'd heard the name before. I'll pull up the trivia. Give me 1 second. Bear with me. In this movie, Kevin Coughlin, as Dewey, washes a windshield while working as a gas station attendant. On January 10th, 1976, at 1:45 a.m., while cleaning his own car's windshield on Ventura Boulevard in Los Angeles, Coughlin was hit by a speeding car and died 9 days later. Well, how about that? So, you are missed, Kevin Coughlin. Now, the third movie of 1968 that I want to talk about is called Live a Little, Love a Little with Elvis Presley. This is the movie that gave us a little less conversation. You know that song? Little less conversation. That became like a big it was a hit again in like 2002 because they did a remix of it. And it became like the theme song for Las Vegas. I think because of the movie's Ocean's Eleven had that song in it. But anyway, this is the original movie where that Elvis song came from. Here is a synopsis for Live a Little, Love a Little. Photographer Greg Nolan moonlights in two full-time jobs to pay the rent, but has trouble finding time to do them both without his bosses finding out. Elvis Presley had crapped out a movie every 2.5 weeks during this time period. But I'm going to give him a point for Elvis Presley, because if you're in a movie with Elvis Presley, you got to get a point. Now, it's 1969, and the decade is winding down. But you know who's not winding down, my friends? Dick Sargent. He starts 1969 with a mind blower, a sitcom paradox that I cannot wrap my brain around. He does an episode of I Dream of Jeannie. What? Is it possible to be on both shows? Can you work with both Samantha and Jeannie? Bewitched and I Dream of Jeannie, he did them both? Is it possible? It is, if you're Mr. Dick Sargent. Then he does, so I'm giving him a point for that, by the way. Then he does Adam 12, an episode of a show called The Outcasts, and then he books Bewitched. So now it's season 6, and there's a new Darren Stevens in town. He would serve as Darren honorably until the show's end in 1972. And that wraps up the 60s for our two dicks. There you go. Let's tally up the scores. Now, here's the thing. I gave Dick York 11 points for the 1960s, giving him a total of 20 points. I gave Dick Sargent, though, 23 points for the 60s, giving him a total of 32. So through the 50s and 60s, Dick Sargent wins 32 to 20. But you know what? Who the hell am I? I've been thinking about this. This doesn't feel fun anymore. You know, I jumped into this, into the deep end. I didn't know how things went for Mr. Dick York. I mean, I knew he left Bewitched because of some problems and chronic pain and some addiction, but I didn't know how severely it ravaged his career. I didn't realize that he didn't work at all from the late 60s until 1983. So again, doesn't sound fun. I don't think these two guys would approve. So I'm going to call it. No more competition. I'm afraid, if nothing else, I'm afraid these guys might haunt me. So let's just scrap the competition and let's just call them both winners. How about we just celebrate these two men? Dick York didn't work in the 70s at all. He eventually beat his addiction. And in the early 80s, he tried to revive his career. In 1983, he did an episode of Simon and Simon, followed up by a 1984 episode of Fantasy Island. His episode was called Games People Play and the Sweet Life. Had a fun cast, of course, as Fantasy Island always does. His final role for Dick York here, his final role was the 1984 TV movie High School USA with Michael J. Fox and Nancy McKeon. We lost Dick York on February 20th, 1992, at the age of 63. Let's read. York died of complications from emphysema at Blodgett Hospital in East Grand Rapids, Michigan on February 20th, 1992 at age 63. He's buried at Plainfield Cemetery in Rockford, Michigan. Despite his suffering, he said, "I've been blessed. I have no complaints. I've been surrounded by people in radio, on stage, and in motion pictures and television who love me. The things that have gone wrong have been simply physical things." So you know what? These guys are both winners. We're going to scrap the competition. I want to say thank you. Thank you to Dick York, really. You're not forgotten. I really appreciate the work you did, all those projects. Of course, you really are the better Darren Stevens, right? Let's face it. You're the more tenured one and maybe the more lovable one as well. So Mr. Dick York, Thank you for all the work. Thank you for all the laughs. Thank you for all the projects. What I'll do going forward is next week, I'm just going to focus on Dick Sargent. We'll call it Dick Sargent Beyond Bewitched. We'll look at Dick Sargent's 70s, 80s, and a few things in the 90s before he too passed away young in his early 60s. So that's going to conclude Sargent versus York. This was part two of that. I'm going to conclude it here. Thank you for listening to the show. If you like Fanacek, please rate it, review it. That always helps. Hit me up at fanacekpodcast@gmail.com. If you'd like stickers, or if you have questions, or if you want me to mention you on the podcast, I can do that. Of course, I'm always on Facebook at Real Fanacek. I'm on Twitter, Fanacek Podcast. And wow, I'm kind of sad. I'm kind of bummed. I jumped into this not knowing that maybe I don't want Dick York to compete with Dick Sargent. Maybe I want them to coexist as two amazing gentlemen to amazing actors who gave us a lot of laughs. So with that said, folks, do me one simple favor. Stay tuned for the next exciting episode of Fanacek.